You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is popular historian Tom Clavin. Former New York Times reporter is the author of a number of books on sports, military, and Western history. His books, The Heart of Everything That Is, biography of the 19th century Lakota chief Red Cloud, and Halsey's Typhoon, about a storm that struck the U.S. Pacific Fleet in the closing days of World War II, were both New York Times bestsellers, as is his most recent book, Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and the Wickedest Town in the American West. It's now out in softcover from St. Martin's Press. In it, Clavin tells the story of the famed Cowtown and does his best to separate fact from myth about the town, its lawmen, and outlaws. It also tells the story of Wyatt Earp, of whom much has been written, and Bat Masterson, whose story is perhaps the most interesting, whose career spanned a start as a buffalo hunter and ended up as a New York City columnist who was the toast of Broadway. Tom Clavin joins me by phone today on Studio Tulsa. Tom Clavin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, your book is titled Dodge City, and you do tell the story of this noted cow town. You really tell much more than that. You tell the stories of Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson. The first is very well known, countless books, countless movies made about him. The last, a little less known, and perhaps what we know is known is not really all that correct. So when you began researching, what did you set out to write about? Was it about Dodge City or was it about the lawmen?
It was really about Bat Masterson, who I was initially interested in, and because of what you just said, he's been so mostly overlooked. I mean, he's a familiar name to many people. Those of a certain age will remember the Bat Masterson show with Gene Barry in the late 1950s, and he's popped up in a couple of movies as a character, usually a very supporting one. And you know, if he's in one with Wyatt Earp, he's basically just there to hold Earp's coat while he does the real work. But I thought, you know, who was Bat Masterson? And I started doing some more research into it, and I found he had a really fascinating life. And that sort of led me to Dodge City because when he and Wyatt were best friends, it was in the Dodge City days. And this is years before Tombstone. I mean, you mentioned that there's been countless movies about Wyatt Earp and television show. I think Hugh O'Brien played him. But mostly what we see is the Wyatt Earp of the Tombstone days, the very self-assured, mature lawman who knows what's right and wrong. And I found out that the Wyatt Earp that interested me more and that hadn't really been covered at all or very, very lightly is the Wyatt Earp of the Dodge City days when he and Bat were still in their 20s. They're very young men and not experienced lawmen at all and really getting their first taste of what taming a town was all about. So it's sort of like start with Bat Masterson, then to Dodge City and to Wyatt Earp, and that's sort of the sequence of events that made me decide that I don't want to do a whole book about Bat Masterson. There's already been a whole book or many whole books about Wyatt Earp, but let me focus on just that period of time in the mid to late 1870s in Dodge City when it was called the wickedest town in the American West.
And it certainly was a crazy town. It was a wide-open boom town, because of the cattle drives ending in Dodge City. And, of course, it was one in a succession of cow towns where the drives would end. Abilene was one,
yeah,
Ellsworth, Wichita, and then Dodge City. Was it a matter of just the railroad moving west?
That was it. I mean, where the railroad went, usually some prosperity followed. Certainly when the railroad was going through Kansas, like you say, the Abilene was a boom town for a short period of time, and there was Ellsworth and there's Wichita. And when you got to Dodge City, what was especially significant about Dodge City was that it was located more in the southwestern part of Kansas. And it was a pretty direct run for these Texas ranchers to send their cattle right up through Texas, through the Panhandle area there, which at that time was sometimes referred to as the Cherokee Strip.
Yeah.
And then you cross the border into Kansas, and you didn't have to. There were towns between the border and Dodge City, but Dodge City is where the railroad was. And so when it was a perfect alignment of railroad and cattle trail that met the epicenter of the frontier for several years was Dodge City.
Well, Bat Masterson is sort of the really admirable figure in this book. What was so appealing about him to you?
There was one thing, is his personality. He was an affable, outgoing guy with a strong constitution who had, at a very young age, still in his teens, distinguished himself as a brave man, as an Army scout, as a buffalo hunter. And he seemed like a real rough-and-tumble kind of guy that was able to survive and enjoy the American frontier. And thank goodness he had the kind of integrity that inspired him to be a lawman, because he probably would have made a pretty formidable outlaw. Would have been a tough guy, I think, to take on. So when he became a lawman, he'd like to do practical jokes. It's funny, because he and Wyatt did become best friends, and you know, Wyatt in his lifetime referred to Bat as a best friend, and Bat in his recollections referred to Wyatt being my best friend. And they were very, very different kind of individuals. I mean, they were somewhat different physically, with Wyatt being tall and lean and Bat being more shorter and stockier. And their personalities were different. Wyatt was a man of few words and not outgoing and rather shy, and also somebody who could not tolerate alcohol. You know, the image, sometimes the movie images of Wyatt and Doc Holliday bellying up to the bar and knocking back shots of whiskey, Wyatt couldn't drink. His constitution wouldn't take it. Bat, on the other hand, was not a drunkard, but he liked going to the saloons and gambling and socializing with other people there and knocking back a few drinks. So they were very, very different people, but they had a very strong bond between them.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that Bat Masterson ended up out in that area as a buffalo hunter. You mentioned he was an Indian scout for a while, but he was really a buffalo hunter that got him started, and at some point he morphed into law enforcement.
Yeah, he was a buffalo hunter. He and his brother Ed were buffalo hunters. That's where he and first met Wyatt Earp, was when they crossed paths as buffalo hunters in the early 1870s. And then in Bat's case, I mean, there is a story in the book that he had had several adventures as a buffalo hunter and Army scout and chasing down several sisters who had been kidnapped by Indians and getting them back, and various adventures. And then he had been shot in a small town in Texas over a dispute with an Army sergeant who they both were in love with the same girl, and Bat was very seriously wounded. And when he recovered, his family, the Masterson farm, was about 12 miles north of Wichita. When he recovered, he had one of his brothers, I think, was living in Dive City, who said to him, "Well, Bat, you got nothing else to do. There's some good gambling here. You can, it's a fun place. Come to Dodge City." And when he did, he said, there's my old friend from buffalo hunting days, Wyatt Earp, who at that time was the assistant marshal. And Bat became a lawman because Wyatt hired him. And that began his journey that lasted for many years as a frontier lawman.
And what was really interesting was these guys were really young, but they were already becoming sheriffs. They were marshals. Mm-hmm. These guys were in their early 20s and yet were put in pretty responsible positions. Was that just the fact that after the Civil War, you know, young men were the people taking a lot of these jobs?
Yeah, well, certainly you had the Civil War had significantly depleted the male population, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of casualties. And I think also you really have people lining up around the block to become lawmen on the frontier. You know, there was no police academy. There were no benefits, you know, for being a peace officer, no 401k. It was a dangerous job, and the judicial system was very rudimentary on the frontier. Your towns were far apart, so it wasn't like if you were going to be in a tough situation, you could say, "Well, I'll ring up my buddy Marshall Jones and have him ride over this afternoon." It was a lot of times you were doing the work of a peace officer by yourself or with a very small police force, maybe you and a couple of deputies. So, you know, if someone was only 21, 22, 23 years old and expressed and had some skills and expressed some interest in becoming a lawman, a lot of communities would say, "Go ahead, give him a badge, let's try him." and in Bat's case in particular, I think he was only 24 years old when he was elected sheriff of Ford County, and Dodge City was part of Ford County, but it was a bigger jurisdiction. So at only 24 years old, he was the sheriff in charge of enforcing the law in an entire county.
The other thing that was sort of interesting about this era was that yes, you might be a professional lawman, but you probably had other interests on the side, and it was all part of this boomtown mentality that, you know, I might own a partial interest in one saloon, but I'm also the marshal or the assistant marshal or, you know, on the town police force or on the county sheriff.
Yeah, I mean, there are things that would be obvious conflicts of interest today that were allowed or at least condoned or ignored back then. I mean, there's a couple of stories in my book, Dodge City, that when Wyatt Earp was a deputy in, I believe it was Wichita, he also moonlighted as a bouncer at his brother's brothel. You know, I think they would frown upon a police officer today who was being a bouncer at a house of prostitution. You know, they were providing security at saloons. They did have business interests. There could be a saloon that's part of the town that you're the sheriff or a marshal of, and you have a partial interest in it. And one obvious reason for that is you didn't get paid very much. In fact, when you got a salary per month for being, let's say, the marshal of a town, but that salary was not very much. And what they also would do is you'd also get like $2.50 per arrest. And so there was almost like a bonus incentive. You know, if you make more arrests, you can make more money. And so there'd also be you get paid for per dog that you shot. If the town was being overrun with too many wild dogs, you know, sometimes the city council would say, we got to reduce the dog population, and the sheriff would get like 50 cents a dog.
Wow.
Now, you know, you had to stitch together a way to make a living.
Now, you just sort of alluded to one of the reasons why we sort of remember Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson today was because they were not killers with a badge, so to speak. They arrested a lot of these cowboys that would come into town. And obviously, there was a financial incentive in doing so, in not shooting them. It was in arresting them.
Right. Some people of a certain age remember the old television show that I think Steve McQueen or Nick Adams, I can't remember who starred in it, but it was called Wanted, Dead or Alive. And we've all seen those posters in Westerns, Wanted. So, you know, there were some situations where you brought somebody in, dead or alive, you were going to get that bounty. But in a lot of these towns, they were actively encouraging arrests over shootings, because if there was more shootings, you never know who's going to get caught in the crossfire. These were, you know, Dodge City was one of the towns that was trying to become, one way to put it, is civilized. They were building churches, building schools. They were, you know, establishing businesses and wanting to see them grow. And if you were having gunfights in the streets, you know, people would not go there to do their business. Even the Texas ranchers, they didn't want their cowboys to be getting killed in a town. And if a place was considered too dangerous, they were going to find the next town over that had the railroad, and they would start bringing their cows there. So Wyatt, when he first got the job, or soon after he got the job in Dodge City, he told his fellow assistant marshals, he said, they didn't hire me to kill people. They hired me to stop people from killing people. And if you were getting paid a certain amount of money to an arrest and you killed somebody instead, you didn't get paid. So you could go broke killing people.
My guest today is Tom Clavin. He is the author of numerous popular histories. His most recent is titled Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and the Wickedest Town in the West. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Well, when you're dealing with these mythic figures of the West, separating fact from fiction can be very difficult. I would think even contemporary newspaper accounts could be suspect, because they were in the business of selling newspapers to make it more lurid,
right,
to sell copy. So how did you go about figuring out all the myths from the facts of these two men's lives?
Well, part of it is trying to read everything that is available, going from newspaper accounts. I mean, you can, thankfully, the archives of the Dodge City Times and the Ford County Globe are digitized, so it's not like you have to go into the basement of one of those newspaper offices and pour through page after page of yellowing, you know, tattered newspaper clippings. So from there, from accounts written by people who knew Bat and Wyatt and some of the other characters, there's some of the books that have been written about Wyatt Earp are mostly hogwash, but... But there are, you know, Casey Terfetiller did a wonderful biography of Wyatt Earp that came out about 20 years ago, which is still the standard as far as, you know, we now know more than even when that book came out. But when that book came out, it really did a great job in humanizing Wyatt Earp, the man behind the myth. I sort of compare it to being a gold prospector by the side of a creek. You know, you keep putting your pan in and lifting out and lifting out and lifting out and sifting through. And if you're lucky at the end of the day, you've got a couple of nuggets that are worth keeping. And that's sort of like the way the research was for this book, to sift through everything, try and find where what seems to be reliable sources corroborate each other. And because Wyatt Earp was not somebody who kept a diary, for example. You have very little in Wyatt Earp's own words about his life. And with Bat Masterson, you are a little lucky because Bat enjoyed writing. And he never sat down to write an autobiography either, but he did like to write about, you know, especially later in his life, he wrote reminiscences about some of the characters that he met. Not that he's 100% accurate either, but you have some of Bat's voice, you know, talking about his own life, which was helpful.
Well, you also have a character in Bat Masterson where he would sell people his Colt revolver with 22 notches on it, and as soon as he sold it, he would go out and purchase another Colt revolver and put 22 notches on it.
Yeah, Bat was, like I said, he's a practical joker, mischievous sense of humor, and he knew later in life that he had this reputation. Even middle of his life, he had this reputation as much of it not deserved as a gunfighter who had dispatched, you know, a couple of dozen outlaws in his bloody career. And he thought, well, you know what, if I can't undo this reputation, it follows me around, I might as well have some fun with it, maybe make a few dollars while I was at it. So that would be what happened later in life, when he'd be in a saloon and some out-of-town rube would come up to him and ask to see this famous gun that he pistol that he carried with the notches in it. And yeah, and then Bat would, after seeming reluctant, sell it to the guy, and the guy would take off and be very happy, go back home and say, look what I've got. And then Bat would go to a pawn shop and buy another pistol and put the notches on it again.
And of course, he didn't kill anywhere near those 22 notches.
No.
And probably maybe just a few, I mean, maybe only a couple of men really in his life.
Yeah, well, they always used to, when these some of these frontier guys would talk about if they've killed anybody, they would always qualify a bit and say, well, exclusive of Indians, you know,
true.
They didn't count as actually killing men. You know, that was just like a necessary thing you had to do to, as part of survival on the frontier. But Bat, you know, a handful at most. I mean, he killed the army sergeant who had killed his girlfriend down in that Texas town. He shot and killed the two guys that killed his brother in Dodge City. There may be one or two others in there, but Bat was not a bloodthirsty type, and he was honest about it. You know, he didn't claim that he had killed all these people, but he knew that there were these stories about him, and he didn't work very hard to convince people otherwise.
What was really striking about the book was what a thin line between law enforcement and lawbreaker there was.
Mm-hmm.
Several times a lawman would be arresting a guy one day and then deputizing them the next. Was that surprising to you?
It was. And it was interesting because, yes, you could have somebody. I mean, Wyatt Earp himself, before he became a lawman on the frontier, I mean, he had, in Lamar, Missouri, where he lived and where he and his first wife were married, he was a constable. So that was really his first job involving law enforcement. But on the frontier, when he started to get these jobs as, you know, assistant marshal and deputy sheriff and things like that, he had been in prison for being a horse thief. And actually being a peace officer was a form of redemption for him. But there are some characters in the book who they show up at different times of the narrative, sometimes as a deputy sheriff and sometimes as a bank robber.
Huh. Was there an interesting fact you found that you're very proud of that you found for this particular book?
Well, I wanted to sort of, I think, to portray these frontier towns, and Dodge City in particular, as places that they didn't really spend a lot of years as these rowdy, hell on wheels kind of towns. It wasn't long before people wanted to turn them into towns where it would be safe enough to raise a family and to build schools and to build churches and to start having, you know, the community band and things like that. And Dodge City was very much like that. It was those few years that the book mostly focuses on when it was the wickedest town in the American West, but people didn't want it to stay that way. You know, even go back a few years earlier to somebody who was like the prototype of the frontier lawman, which was Wild Bill Hickok, and he was the marshal of Abilene for a year, and it was a very eventful year. But what they wanted, he was fired after 1 year because they said, okay, you've done a good job, but we want somebody who's going to be more peaceful and more civilized because that's what we want Abilene to be. And that also happened in Dodge City where Bat and Wyatt and several others, you know, guys like Charlie Bassett and Jim Masterson and others, they did a good job. And so when you get to the later in the 1870s, both Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson are looking to move on because their job is done here for the most part, and Dodge City was going to become a very different place from what it originally was.
One of the things I was struck about by the book was how factional politics played a role in that particular boom town. You know, when you think of a place like Tombstone, which you do spend a little time, but not a whole lot of time in the book, you know, the factional politics was a very big part of that Tombstone story involving the Earps.
Yeah.
It's been related many times. But what seems apparent is these factional politics were in play in virtually every boom town. It was not enough just to make money. It was you had to control the town, and it seemed to be very much a part of Dodge City as well.
Well, yeah, because if you controlled the town, you controlled a lot of the revenue. And, yeah. And so that they went hand in hand. I mean, there was politics as we know it. And Bat, for example, was a lifelong Republican, and he was involved in Republican Party politics in Kansas. There's that aspect of politics, you know, Republican versus Democrat. But there's the politics of the administrations wanting to assert their will to pass laws, and this would allow them to control the money. You know, one of the things that happened with Dodge City as it evolved into a more civilized place is that the laws became more restrictive as far as gambling, prostitution, you know, higher penalties for routine crimes. And a big reason why the book begins with a prologue.
Yes, it does.
Of Bat and Wyatt returning to Dodge City in 1883 for what would be called the Dodge City War. And what brought that about is that a new administration had come in and basically said, you know what, let's throw a lot of those laws out. Let's throw Dodge City wide open again and let it go back to being the rowdy town that it used to be, because we'll get everybody, especially those in the saloon business, for example, will make more money that way. And so these pleas went out to, you know, I think Bat was found in Colorado and Wyatt was someplace else, and the telegrams found them and said, come back. You know, the job that you thought was done has got to be done again. And so that was an example of a new administration come in, and they wanted to control the revenue that you know, obviously, if you have a new administration that's made up of saloon owners, you want to maximize your profits, so you get rid of the laws that were restrictive.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about this Dodge City War, because it ends the book as well, and what we find out, it really wasn't a war; it was a near war. But
yeah, it was a near war, and I do the prologue where Bat is on a train and he's coming to Dodge City. He'll reunite there with Wyatt Earp and several other men are there. And they're going to have to, as far as they know, or as far as they anticipate, there could be a shooting war. And the mayor and his group are going to be wanting to keep Earp and Bat and their group out of Dodge City. And so what eventually did happen was that just the presence of Wyatt and Bat and their associates, ruefully call themselves the Dodge City Peace Commission, just their presence, just their arrival in town, made the town lawmakers say, you know what, we better reconsider because we don't want to take on these guys. And basically what was called a war never ended up being a gun battle, and Dodge City was allowed to, it had derailed for a while, but now it was able to get back on the tracks and, you know, keep going, try to be a progressive city and eventually become the city that's there today.
But, you know, what's interesting is that wasn't uncommon in the West. You know, the Lincoln County War, there's a war in Trinidad. And it was, again, these competing factions battling for control of who was going to make the laws. And oftentimes in those times, they would turn to gunslingers and people with a gun to handle the conflict.
Yeah, well, there's a story in the book about, I think it was the Royal Gorge War, I think it was called, where you had two competing railroads. You know, they both wanted the right to build track through this gorge, and they couldn't come to a settlement, so they started hiring guys to go to war with each other. And one railroad hired Bat Masterson, who brought along Doc Holliday. And there was actually, you know, some fighting that actually went on before the whole thing was stopped. But that's exactly what you're talking about. You know, even private interests like railroad companies would hire these guys as mercenaries to do their fighting for them.
Well, you, after the Dodge City era ended, you document what happened to Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson. Wyatt Earp went west. He went to the Klondike. He was always looking for the big score. He never really happened, although he was... but for Bat Masterson, it really was. He befriended Theodore Roosevelt. He made him the U.S. Marshal for the Southern District of Manhattan, and eventually became a sports writer and was really a beloved figure in New York for many years.
He was, and I think that's one of the reasons that... I mean, I didn't know a lot of this when I was first doing the research and how delighted I was to find out that, you know, Bat was not really a secondary character, a second banana. He was a very, you know, effective lawman in his own right, and then went on to have, like, these other careers. And he did, you know, in the 1880s when Bat was living in the Dakotas and as a lawman there, he befriended this young guy from New York who was trying his hand at ranching, and it was Theodore Roosevelt. And then they stayed friends, and they corresponded with each other. And when Bat turned 50, by that time, Roosevelt was president, and Bat wrote to Roosevelt and said, I'm a little concerned that some guy's going to come along. I have this reputation. A lot of it's not deserved, but somebody's just going to gun me down, thinking, okay, now I'm the fastest gun in the West. And Roosevelt said, well, come to New York. I'll make you the deputy U.S. Marshal for New York. And that's what Bat, and by that time he was married, he and his wife came to New York, and he did that for a while. He became a newspaper man and spent the rest of his life in New York writing for the newspapers and a very popular column. And as a raconteur, you know, at the end of the evening, he could be found at one of his favorite saloons along Broadway and telling stories, and he would attract quite a crowd. And one of his proteges at the newspaper was a young reporter named Damon Runyon. and Runyon would later write the stories upon which Guys and Dolls are based on, and some people may recall that the main character of Guys and Dolls is Sky Masterson, the gambler. And that's, Runyon named him after Bat Masterson. That was his way to honor Bat Masterson, somebody who he came to really admire.
What's a fascinating book. The name of it is Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and the Wickedest Town in the West. Tom, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Historian and journalist Tom Clavin speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and the Wickedest Town in the West. It's published in softcover by St. Martin's Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Rigsby at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.